With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to Pick a Flick, a weekly film podcast where you pick a film and we talk about it. We can be found on Twitter at Pick a Flick Pod. We are on iTunes, Acast, Stitcher and Facebook as well. So if you could, please go follow us, like us, poke us, leave reviews and genuinely interfere with us in whichever social media platform will let you. That'd be fantastic. I'm Steve Norman, usually of Failed Critics. I'm joined by Leslie Pitt of Afro Film Viewer.
Hi, how you doing? You alright?
Yes, good, thank you. So yes, we're going to, as always done, pick a flick, go through a few films selected by yourselves, the listeners. So let's pick a flick. Zero Dark Thirty is a 2012 American action thriller film directed by Kathryn Bigelow and written by Mark Boal, billed as the story of history's greatest manhunt for the world's most dangerous man. The film dramatises a decade-long manhunt for Al-Qaeda leader Osama bin Laden after the September 11, 2001 terrorist attacks in the United States. This search eventually leads to the discovery of his compound in Pakistan and a military raid that resulted in bin Laden's death on May 2nd, 2011, and this film was chosen for us by Teresa, and I'm going to apologise if I butcher your surname, Votipakova. I may well have got that wrong.
I think you did okay, but we'd have to wait and see what she says.
Yes. In future reference, if you have a difficult surname, please send us a phonetic spelling of it so we can get it right and not insult your good selves.
I want to make something absolutely clear. If you thought there was some secret cell somewhere working Al-Qaeda, then I want you to know that you're wrong. This is it. There's no working group coming to the rescue. There's nobody else hidden away on some other floor. There is just us. And we are failing. We're spending billions of dollars. People are dying. We are still no closer to defeating our enemy. They attacked us on land in 98. By sea in 2000, and from the air in 2001. They murdered 3,000 of our citizens in cold blood. And they have slaughtered our forward deployed. And what the fuck have we done about it, huh? What have we done? We have 20 leadership names. We've only eliminated 4 of them. I want targets. Do your fucking jobs. Bring me people to kill.
Zero Dark Thirty, then. Obviously set, as we mentioned, the manhunt for Osama bin Laden. Very well-received film, and it was nominated for 5 different Oscars at the 85th Academy Awards, including Best Picture, Best Actress for Jessica Chastain, Best Original Screenplay, and some of the more technical awards. Are we fans of the film?
I love the film, personally. Yeah, I'm a big, big fan of the film. I remember when it came out, and I found myself very sort of moved by it, considering what it's about and how it gets to its end and all those aspects of it. I think it's a very dark, dark film in terms of what it, you know, and what it talks about and how it's written, so to speak, and how it was researched and the sort of fallout that came out of that, and when Ball wrote the film and he and Bigelow were doing all this research, and they were researching it before Bin Laden was caught and captured, and then there was script changes and rewrites because of it, and there was a whole bunch of fallout, and there was many, many articles written about it saying they can't do this because of things that you see at the beginning of the film. I think that's one of the more interesting aspects of the film. I think there is an element of truth in there that we don't want to face. There's lots of people going, it signals that waterboarding was and torture was a way of finding Bin Laden, but what you actually find out is it doesn't really give you too much hints. But also, these things are actually happening, and if they did give any hints, you get the feeling there's a whole bunch of people that don't want anyone to find out and know for sure what actually happened. I think that's the thing I really like about it. It goes through a very murky way of doing things, and it melds fact and fiction in such a way that you feel dirty for watching it, and I think it makes the end shot very more resonant, so to speak. I know I'm one of the only people that really sometimes feels this, because now, 4 years on, people aren't really talking about the film anymore, but for me it was one of the best films of that year.
What surprised me when just looking into the film, and especially reading the introduction we gave to it there, was obviously Bin Laden's death, as we mentioned, was the 2nd of May 2011. The film was released in 2012, very close to the actual event, so it must have been written in, maybe they were writing in advance and keeping it updated as it went on, but who knows. But it just seems quite close to it actually to be released. We know how militaries and governments like to keep certain things under wraps and confidential, but you would have thought that the screenwriters would want to make this as accurate as possible. So you wonder how they managed to do that with it being so close to the event, and there probably being, you know, all kinds of inquiries and investigations from the government as to how it actually happened, how it went down, and then kind of 18 months after the event, a film's released on the subject.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those things where you get the feeling that something was put in place as a kind of work of fiction as this was all going along, and then real life kind of got in the way. I think it's a kind of, I think I commend the filmmakers to turn around and make something that is as coherent as tense as they do, considering that they have to go and do reshoots. You know, we hear about reshoots all the time and how they kind of, you know, excuse my French, kind of fuck up the film sometimes. I will turn around and Steve, your podcast Failed Critics, where one of my favourite episodes is the Fantastic Four episode, where everyone's talking about the fact that you can see Kate Mara's wig changing on and off all the time, and that aspect of it. One thing I really enjoy about Zero Dark Thirty is it's almost seamless, and you still look at it as a work of fiction. I still look at it as a work of fiction with elements of truth kind of thrown in there. Obviously, the main character played by Jessica Chastain is not a real character. I think there was rumours of her maybe being a composite of people, but no, she's not a real character, so therefore you can't land it in truth, so to speak. But you can say that there are elements that are, you know, elements of truth that inspired the film. I think that's the most interesting thing about it, when we look at that and then you look at it compared to other films, sort of like American Sniper, where because it's written down as a biography, everyone takes it as a sort of element of truth no matter what. And I can't remember when the writer of American Sniper died in real life, but no one seems to really question that aspect of it, especially from the fact that it's from one perspective and one very hawkish and right-wing perspective. Whereas this, yes, there was kind of things that happened, things that didn't happen, and they had to do a massive turnaround, but there seemed to be a lot more things, lots more attacks of it trying to derail it, especially from the fact that it was going to be a prestige film and looking towards Oscars. I may be completely wrong, though. I'm not sure. I talk too much, so...
it's a bit America fuck yeah, isn't it?
Mm. I mean, the worrying thing is there was, you know, when we're now in the era of Trump, who is very, very quick to tweet and brag and boast and talk about bringing back aspects like waterboarding and everything else like that. And it is scary, and the interesting thing is, this is a film that shows those tactics and sometimes hints that maybe it came to certain findings, maybe it came to certain red herrings, but it hints that those things were done. And then you had people like John McCain kind of speaking out against the film, going, well, no, and speaking out against people like Trump as well, and being a prisoner of war. And the thing that bothers and scares and worries me about the film, and I think that's why it's so interesting, is it never really pertains to whether or not you think it's a good thing or not. It's just a thing that happened. It's very matter of fact that such an aspect may or may not have happened. And we know these sort of things weren't out of reach when you look at documentaries like Taxi to the Dark Side or hear anything about things that were happening or may not have happened in Guantanamo. It's a scary aspect, and it's one of those things where you hear from either side, both for or against, and did it happen and didn't happen, and it just makes things murky. And I think one of the things that I like about the film, and I mention again, is you're seeing fictional characters interact with things that may have happened, and it just puts you on a certain type of edge. You know it's a work of fiction because of certain things, but you also know there's truth in the fiction. That is kind of scary. I can't think of another film in recent times that kind of mentions 7/7 in the way that this does. And I also think one of the things that I find quite interesting is how it uses these real-life events to punctuate where we are in the story and what's happening. There's the one thing about the 7/7 aspect of it, which is a good and a bad thing. You can say it kind of romanticizes and glamorizes certain aspects of its usage. But one thing it turns around and says is, we need to step this stuff up. There needs to be something to be done, whether or not it's good or bad. Something is happening, and this is what we need to do. And the thing that I like so much is there's all these office, you know, there's lots and lots of men talking in offices and people walking around and talking about where things are and yelling and bickering and trying to suss certain things out. But you just get, there's just this element of haste and worry and just you're seeing the nature of what we know as war unraveling in front of our very eyes, and you're seeing a whole bunch of people going, well, how do we deal with this? And I think that's what the film gets right. I don't necessarily need to watch a fictional film to get the facts, but I do like the idea of you're getting some sort of elements of what someone like Herzog would say is an ecstatic truth, a sort of element of, oh my God, you can imagine these people, you know, you can imagine your Rumsfelds and your Cheney's going, what the hell are we going to do about this? How are we going to go about this? Is this the right way? We need to sign off on this. And I think that's what makes the film work, even though, you know, it's played by, you know, some of the characters are played by guys who were in, what was it, Early Edition, if you remember that short, kind of a short-lived TV show, Kyle Chandler. And also Chris Pratt turns up in it at one point. It was very strange.
The one that threw me the most was John Barrowman turning up, because at the point I'd seen this, he'd only been as Captain Jack Harkness in Doctor Who and a very camp person on British TV. And he turns up in kind of, although it's a very small role, like kind of some super serious military role. I'm like, that's John Barrowman. this just isn't right. This isn't the John Barrowman that I know.
For me, it was seeing people like Mark Duplass turn up, and you just kind of question what you've just seen. Knowing who Mark Duplass is, and knowing that he's this guy that kind of does these mumblecore movies, and for most people, they may have just watched him on Netflix in The League, and he kind of just turns up in this film, and you go, oh, what? But the thing that I think I really enjoy about it is it's cast very well. It's cast with an eye for what you would imagine what people in this position would be like, as opposed to stars. And I think that's quite important. I think that's something that we sometimes miss from many films, because obviously there's a commercial aspect that needs to go through with it. But what did you think of the last sequence? The actual spoilers storm and kind of raid.
It was quite gripping, wasn't it? And quite gripping and exciting. It was, I mean, for a war film, there wasn't much warring going on for a lot of Zero Dark Thirty. It's all kind of a lot of build up to trying to find out where Bin Laden was, and all the kind of politics involved in getting missions and things signed off and planning on what they're going to do. And then the last bit was kind of all out action, which kind of very tense, very gripping. Kind of all filmed in the dark, and you know, night vision and that kind of thing. And it all looked very exciting.
Yeah, I mean, I can see what you mean in terms of the aesthetic. They do have that sort of similar thing. I wouldn't put the two together in terms of, for me, I wouldn't put the two together in terms of ranking them. For me, they both do very well in the things that they need to do. Although they do have similar messages that these wars that are fighting, be it against terrorism or drugs, we are left in the dark for so long and we have no idea, and sometimes it may be better for us not to know, even though morally we may feel a bit dirty. I'm a big, big fan of how these films look. I think there's a crispness, and there's a very stark, you know, it's not high contrast, but it's very contrasted, bright and dark aspects that go through it. There's that fantastic moment in this where you've got, I can't remember, I think it's one of the leads that they're chasing, and there's people in kind of in burkas and saris all kind of closing in. And all these just shadows coming towards this one person, and I just think it's a really effective way of doing it, and it's edited so crisply and cleanly in order to kind of to do that. I mean, even when you're down in the humdrums and the murkiness and the night vision, I feel that the geography of this is sublime. Like, you know what's happening, you know where people are, you know who you're looking at. And you know why you're looking at them. You know, it's one of those things that I've always loved about having a director like Kathryn Bigelow. She is an underrated action director. She doesn't make too many of them, but they seem to be more talked about in terms of cult as opposed to anything else, as opposed to someone like John McTiernan or the like. And, you know, everyone laughs at how cheesy Point Break is, and everyone kind of, you know, and only horror fans really talk about Near Dark, but I think action wise she really knows how to do geography. She really knows how to make the actions sing, so to speak. You wait so long in this, all this talk about this, and then there's this heavily done night sequence, and then afterwards you're supposed to feel this moment of catharsis, and then she pulls it back, and I think that's really expertly done. The idea that you know, morally you should feel conflicted. I think that's really hard to do, and I think some people kind of take that for granted. And going back to what we were mentioning before about the fact that this was kind of, you know, there was 18 months and then there was rewrites as well, the idea that you can still get that sort of emotional resonance is quite a tribute to her as a director.
So that third, who was up for Best Picture, Best Actress for Jessica Chastain, Best Original Screenplay, and a couple of the, like, the technical awards as well. Best Sound Editing and that kind of thing. She was nominated for a Golden Globe as Best Director.
She's in nearly every scene of this movie, and it's one of those things where it's about 2.5 hours, and she makes sure that you remember who she is. She does show her, you know, elements of femininity in there, as well as the fact that she's a badass, and she wants to make sure this job gets done well. And it's one of those things on where when I'm reading all these blogs and articles about like aspects of diversity and women behind the camera, and I think a film like this helps show what a woman behind the camera like Kathryn Bigelow can do, because I'm sure she worked very hard with Chastain to try and get the right balance of this woman being so driven and yet in such a strange situation. I don't think you could have a man do this at times. I think the idea of having a woman as the lead works, and works really well. But then again, you know, I kind of expect that from someone like Bigelow, who's done stuff like this in films like Blue Steel with Jamie Lee Curtis. Once again, just another film that is really stylish, kind of forgotten now, but has some interesting elements and definitely worth seeing. And I think, once again, when Bigelow directs men, she directs them really well. But it's when she directs women and she makes them so driven and work like, it's almost like a Michael Mann film at times. She you get these inner lives and how they haven't got time for these niceties that we always expect women to have in films. And I think it really shows, and I think it really works well. She shows a different side of femininity that just doesn't get seen enough.
Should we move on to kind of a wider discussion on modern war films, and probably to clarify, it's films set in modern wars rather than war films made from any war made recently. So you're kind of looking, I suppose, the Afghan war post 9/11 onwards. For me, the most noticeable thing about these things is you really can notice how war has changed between, say, World War II and then later Vietnam, to how war is fought now. You can, if you say watch something like Saving Private Ryan, and then watch say Apocalypse Now, and then watch something like Zero Dark Thirty or Jarhead or American Sniper, you really get a sense of the way that war has changed and the way wars are fought.
Yeah, I also think the interesting thing is kind of morally and tactically how these wars have completely changed. One of my favourite war films is an anti-war film. It's Kubrick's Path of Glory, and the whole point of that is you're seeing Kirk Douglas caught in a catch-22, that he knows that he's damned if he does, damned if he doesn't. It's a suicide mission. You're not seeing that so much in modern war films because of the nature of the tech. It's as simple as that. I mean, if we bring up Jarhead, the thing that makes Jarhead so interesting is they're looking back at all these old war films and old wars and going, hang on, this isn't what we signed up for. We expected to fight. We expected to see certain things. And they don't see that. That's not there anymore. The grunt's work is kind of changed. It's different now. I find that to be quite interesting. And I find it to be the kind of driving force that we are now more technologically advanced, that we can see how wars have just changed and how that conflicts with people in, say, stuff like Jarhead, but also how, because of the amount of information and being in this age of information, you see films like Green Zone and how you're fighting for warheads that may or may not be there, and it's quicker and easier, and people can get landed in it quicker, and we can go to war quicker, and there doesn't seem to be any sort of treaties or anything else like it in the way that we do go to war. I'm sure there probably is. I'm sure there's probably lots and lots of conversations on whether or not we do that, but it seems to happen at record speed, as opposed to when we look into the past. And the thing I absolutely love about certain modern war films is they make the whole thing murky. My big issue with the likes of American Sniper, that we've kind of hinted on before, is just how gung-ho they make things, and just how that patriotism is quite kind of misplaced. I find it very, very troubling when I was writing about American Sniper and googling about certain reactions and seeing some of the hate-filled tirades and tweets by people, because obviously it was based on a certain true story. This guy turned up and he did the talk shows and everything else like that, and he made the book that came out. And no matter what Clint Eastwood was trying to do with that movie, I think the message didn't show. I think what happened was there was a lot of people that kind of got very, very ooh-rah about it, and that was quite troubling. If there's anything about modern war movies, and we're seeing a pattern of this happen with Lone Survivor, American Sniper, and then we had recently Michael Bay's Benghazi film that came out this January, and they all seem to come out around January, and they all get and reactions to it from a general audience is you can't say anything bad about this because patriotism.
I expect this is even worse in America.
Yeah,
if this was, say, an American podcast with American people contributing, I'm not saying that a proper film reviewer would have that as an issue, but general public in America, when they're just talking between friends and whatever, if they said, I didn't really like a American Sniper because it was a bit, you know, it was a bit so-and-so, then their buddies might go, well, that's a bit unpatriotic. You know, it's about America and how good we are and how we're fighting a good war for the American people and for freedom and everything. How can you not like this film?
And it's also important to realise that in films like American Sniper, it does kind of confuses the two wars, the Afghanistan war and the war in Iran, to try and, it fudges those two wars and kind of makes them into one, to have the character be a driver, to drive towards going back and serving. And that's a kind of troubling aspect of what's going on. You know, for all the issues that come with something like Zero Dark Thirty, at least it was trying to be quite clear and punctuating certain aspects. It goes down to the, you know, one road. It's about Bin Laden, and these are all coming from seemingly one source. It doesn't confuse two wars. You know, it's more about one aspect, not the other. That's kind of worrying so many people didn't get so gung-ho and patriotic about Zero Dark Thirty, mostly because it was trying to, I don't know, give more of an element of truth, whether or not you believe it does. Whereas, you know, the Lone Survivor things and everything else like that, it's a little bit like how I feel about police and police, especially in America, where you can't say anything bad about what they do, even though they do make mistakes. You're not allowed to say that. If you say that, you're considered, you seem to forget all the other good works. It's like, no. It's very worrying, the fact that constructive criticism of these establishments and these authoritative establishments are are lost, especially when you watch them in films which kind of blur fiction and truth. I think it's important to, you know, it's not just about the catharsis of violence. It's about saying, how can we stop this stuff from happening? But I don't know. That's me being far too left-wing for my own good.
I mean, I suppose it depends on the kind of film you're telling. If you're telling something really, you know, in a really serious way, something that's going to be up for an Oscar, like Hurt Locker or like American Sniper or Zero Dark Thirty, then you do have to really watch how you're portraying your message. If you're doing something like the Michael Bay film Benghazi, then, you know, he just wants guns and explosions, as is his want. There's probably not much of a message to the way that war is fought and morals in that film. It's probably like, we're goodies, they're baddies.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Guns, explosions, done.
The interesting thing is he... I haven't seen Benghazi as of yet, but I wouldn't be surprised if Bay shoots and portrays everything similar to how he portrays the army and everything in Transformers. He's a very straight-cut director. And despite his, you know, his talk about being kind of apolitical and his films being apolitical of sorts, they're very hawkish, you know, in their own special way. I can't say that for me at Benghazi yet, and I hate the fact that I'm doing that thing that I hate other people for doing, going, I haven't seen it yet, but looking at his other films, I wouldn't be surprised if it takes a very cut and dry look at, you know, army and war and warfare, as opposed to Peter Berg, who is just as glitzy as Bay when he wants to be, but brings across, you know, at least a certain, slightly naive, but at least he brings a certain aspect about it, which is quite interesting in The Kingdom, which I did quite enjoy. I thought it was going to be kind of a plain movie, but I actually thought it was way better than I expected. But I think that comes with time. I think the interesting thing about films is some films is you do need that space between them for maybe an immediate reaction, and especially when you look at what they're talking about.
And I mean, just to I suppose round off this part, what are kind of favourite modern war films? I'm a big fan of Jarhead, which is released a fair while ago now. It's starring Jake Gyllenhaal, who will come on to in one of our next film that we're going to review later, incidentally. But I just thought Jarhead was really good, and perhaps a good and more accurate portrayal of how a soldier actually copes in war, or in that kind of war environment, and after the war. Or not after the war, but after they've finished their part in it.
Well, yeah, I think the thing about Jarhead is, I think it kind of, it's one of the films that shows that this is about people on all aspects. It doesn't really show the enemy, but it shows, you know, what's affecting us on the Allied side, the so-called winning side, and what you have to come back home to and what happens there. Another film that strangely tries to show that kind of sobering effect is Monsters, Dark Continent. which is strange because it's a sci-fi film. But as a war film, you can see what it was trying to do and trying to use the aliens as metaphor for that sort of aspect and trying to say that there are real, there's, you know, there's a real innocence that's being lost in this, which kind of harks back to, like I was saying, films like Paths of Glory or the anti-war films of Kubrick and whatnot, and they're a little less gung-ho. For me, I think one of the most interesting war films is actually a documentary that came out last year. It didn't get a big release, and unfortunately it did get a release, I'm not sure if it was DVD release or cinematic release, which came out around the same time as the Paris attacks, and it was called Tell Spring Not to Come This Year. And it was a documentary about what happened to the Afghanistan army after the troops from America and Britain had left. And it's an unbelievably sobering tale about what happens to, you know, what, you know, this massive vacuum of what happens afterwards. We say that we're going to bring all this training, we say that we're going to do this and that and the other, but what actually happens is a kind of, oh, well, we've secured what we needed and we leave. That's what the documentary pertains to. But it would be very interesting to watch along the lines of something like the Pat Tillman Story, another interesting war documentary, and Taxi to the Dark Side. All very interesting films, which kind of give a little bit more truth and a little bit more sobering effect on everything. And actually very troubling because you're seeing real faces and real victims and what happens to them. Sorry, I'm making this a bit of a downer. I mean, one thing I would love to see is, considering there was a lot of talk in the last year about the Conservatives selling arms to Saudi Arabia and the whole aspects of human rights and that going on, and I don't want to go to delve too much into the people who are listening, their political leanings and whatnot, but it would be quite interesting to have a whole bunch of people go back and watch something like Lord of War with Nicolas Cage, directed by Andrew Niccol. I can't remember when it came out, but the idea of, you know, seeing a gun runner and seeing what happens, you know, that opening sequence of the journey of a bullet would be very interesting to see with a lot of people, a lot of political parties, just to see what they would say, as opposed to anything else, whether they would just clam up and they would go very political and you know, very, and the media training would kick in, or whether or not someone would actually turn around and go, oh my goodness, why have I never seen this movie? What's going on? That's what I would like to see. I would like more films that kind of delve into, I don't need to necessarily see the truth, but I would like to see how the politics would, you know, the murkiness of the politics and how difficult and how troubling that actually is. Let's not attack the leaders too much, be it Blair or Cameron. I'm guessing they do have very hard jobs. But I think it's one of those things where it's like, I do want to see the films that make you wonder if they ever, how they sleep at night, probably on a big bed of money. And I mean that both Labour and Conservative, believe me, they all want us dead. Anyway, but yeah, that's what I would like to see.
So, some feedback then from Twitter for favourite modern warfare films. We've got at Andrew, we've got at Brooker 411, that's Andrew Brooker, Lone Survivor, Despite the Spoilery Title, Jarhead, Black Hawk Down, and The Hurt Locker. Emma Platt at Dead Meat Emma, Lord of War, Matt Latham, which is X and Matt, Not American Sniper, which he repeats three times, so I'm guessing he's not a fan of that one. And Student Film Review, which is at Stu Film Review. Until Rainbow Six is made, it'd have to be Patriot Games, and Splinter Cell's coming out next year, so that will be good. that looks like it's two adaptations of video games to the big screen, which does have a patchy track record at best.
We'll have to see. Very worried about any video game becoming a movie as someone who bought Super Mario Brothers to try and write about it.
A braver man than most. So it's once again time for us to pick a flick. Donnie Darko is a 2001 America fantasy drama film written and directed by Richard Kelly. It stars Jake Gyllenhaal, Jenna Malone, Drew Barrymore, Mary McDonnell, Catherine Ross, Patrick Swayze, Noah Wyle, and Maggie Gyllenhaal. The film follows the adventures of the troubled titular character as he seeks the meaning behind his doomsday-related visions. Budgeted with $4.5 million and filmed over the course of 28 days, Donnie Darko grossed just under $7.7 million worldwide. It received positive reviews and developed a cult following, resulting in the release of a director's cut on a two-disc special edition DVD in 2004.
Ling Ling finds a wallet on the ground filled with money. She takes the wallet to the address on the driver's license but keeps the money inside the wallet. I'm sorry, Miss Farmer, I don't get this.
Just place an X on the lifeline in the appropriate place.
No, I mean, I know what to do. I don't get this. You can't just lump things into two categories. Things aren't that simple.
The lifeline is divided that way.
Well, life isn't that simple. I mean, who cares if Ling Ling returns the wallet and keeps the money? Has nothing to do with either fear or love.
Fear and love are the deepest of human emotions.
Okay, but you're not listening to me. There are other things that need to be taken into account here, like the whole spectrum of human emotion. You can't just lump everything into these two categories and then just deny everything else.
If you don't complete the assignment, you'll get a zero for the day.
Donald, let me preface this by saying that your Iowa test scores are intimidating. So, let's go over this again. What exactly did you say to Ms. Farmer?
I'll tell you what he said. He asked me to forcibly insert the lifeline exercise card into my anus.
Now, my biggest memory before a rewatch of Donnie Darko was it came out when I was 14 or 15, and everyone at school was watching it and pretending to be really cool and clever by understanding it, and none of us knew what was going on. and I still don't know if I do now. I think I've got slightly better grasp on what was happening than I did when I was 15. But, yeah, I just remember everyone trying to be, oh, have you seen Donnie Darko? Oh, it's all about this. And when you think back, you think, we didn't have a clue. We really didn't know what was going on.
I remember the second time I watched it. I won't lie, I was a bit of an unabashed. I was in college at the time, and I was a bit of an unabashed Donnie Darko fiend. I went to London to see it the first time. The second time, I think I watched it at college, and then the third time I watched it at a cinema in Henley, and I remember going with. It was a big group of us, and there were some girls, and everyone, all the blokes came out and were going, yeah, you know, so, you know, look at the complexity of it all, and this, that, and the other, and the girls were like, it's not that complex. No, it's fine. Basically, you know, and they just went over the end, he did this because of this, and I was like, oh, right, okay, fine, fair enough. They hit the nail on the head while everyone else was looking at more complex aspects. I love the film. I watched it six times at the cinema when it first came out, and rewatching it just reminded me of some really nice memories. It's just a fantastic come-of-age story. I have a lot of time for that movie. I have a lot of time for the performances. I think it's interesting to see that the theatrical version is far more interesting than the director's cut. I think there is something interesting about that mystery about it, I also think that some of the music choices that we know of in the theatrical cut are so important. They're now kind of engraved onto fans' brains. So the idea that the director went and changed all that is kind of hard. But then again, with that said, we've all been down that route with Blade Runner, haven't we? So, yeah, I really love the film. Kelly's an interesting subject. He is someone that I think... I mean, I could go into the history of the film from what I remember quite easily. I remember, it was at a time where you'd go to movie websites and go, oh my god, what is this website about? If you go, it's still on the archives, it's still there in Flash, and it's got all these clues on what actually happened, quote unquote, and everything. But Kelly himself, I think the interesting thing for me is when Donnie Darko came out, it came out in 2001, came out very soon around the time of 9/11 in America, and because of that it kind of got, I'm not sure if it got delayed or it just didn't make that much money, because obviously there is a plane that crashes, so in terms of sensibilities they looked around and see what they could do. When we got it here in England, it was 2002, and it came out to big fanfare, and it was, I don't know what it was, but it was something about what, when it was released in England and the amount of people they watched in England, that made people kind of stand up and go, hang on a minute. And a lot of people suggest that the success it was in England, in terms of, it wasn't out on many screens, but when it was out in screens, people went to watch it, was quite interesting. And it obviously gave enough so Kelly could go back and make the director's cut and give it more explanation. I don't necessarily feel that you have to get films all the time in order to enjoy them, and I also feel that you don't have to get films to dislike them. And it's one of those things on where the film came out and people were kind of happy with what they had seen, and this director's cut comes out with all this explanation and more talk about the philosophy of time travel and all this stuff. And from what I heard, is the film is a for many fans is a lesser film for it. To kind of cut the short story short, a couple of years after, I think it's 2007. Yeah, it was about 6 years. Sorry, after around 2006, 2007, maybe 2005. Kelly went out and with his magnum opus, which is Southland Tales, which is 3 hours long. And if you felt confused about Donnie Darko, my god, this film has got, it's overkill. There's too many plot strands, there's too many things. I've watched it 3 times, I still don't get it. It's 3 hours long. It wanted to be this big interactive multimedia thing with comic books and The Rock's in it, and he's the lead character, and he's running around with Sarah Michelle Gellar, who's a porn actress, and there's all this stuff about crude oil and marketed wars and all this stuff. And you just get the feeling that Kelly was really angry about all this stuff, and he wanted to try and put it out on paper as an artist, and it just doesn't work. I think one of the reasons why Donnie Darko works as well as it did with so many people is the through line was very simple. No matter what the time travel and the sci-fi was about, that didn't matter, because it was about this boy and him growing up and his self-sacrifice and all those aspects. Whereas Kelly went on to do Southland Tales, and if you go on Twitter and you speak to Richard Kelly and go, what was this aspect of Southland Tales about, he'll tell you exactly what it's about. But you know, you don't explain a good joke, it just works. I think that's one thing that I find that works really well with Donnie Darko, is the little moments. There's that fantastic moment in the film where Donnie goes to his mum, what's it like to have a psycho as a son? And she just goes, it's wonderful. And it's such a small and sensitive moment. that I really love. It's those little things that I think worked really well for the movie. I love the fact that it still looks really good now, considering that it was only 4.5 million and they had to, you know, ask for some favours from some people in order to get, you know, the effects and everything. I think it's a really sensitive movie, and I think it captures the era well. I think it does capture that kind of weirdness with Dukakis and Reagan and that aspect, and this kind of TV family dealing with something that even nowadays, you know, mental health, that we don't deal with very well. But these are all very grounded things that we can deal with. Something that Southland Tales doesn't do very well. And then Kelly went on to do The Box in 2009, which is based on a Richard Matheson, I think it's based on a Richard Matheson short story, which I think called Button Button. I think it was a Twilight Zone episode with James Marsden and Cameron Diaz, and it didn't work out very well. It didn't, you know, once again, it's a bit overkill. It goes a little bit, it takes something that is quite simple and it just plows it with all these other plot strands that kind of go to nowhere if you're not really interested. I think Donnie Darko works because it's so simple, as well as being complex. I think
part of the enjoyment of Donnie Darko and films of its ilk are trying to understand it, trying to work out what exactly going on, why it's happening, what it's all about, and then discussing it with other people who've seen it afterwards.
Yeah.
It's one of those kind of films where people interpret different things in different ways, and it's enjoyable to talk about what you got from it, if you think other people are right or wrong, or if they agree with you or whatever, or if you talk about it with them and then realise that, hang on, I've been completely wrong from the start.
I'm not sure about right or wrong. I think the thing that got me about the film was how I felt afterwards. I feel it was just the emotion. I think for the last 15 years, we've been kind of... modern movies have kind of spoon-fed plot to us. And there's reasons, you know, there's reasons why. When you look at Marvel movies, and I'm not arguing against Marvel movies so much, I'm just making a point that there's so much going on in these movies, and there's so many plot strands and everything else like that. What happens is you've got the dialogue, and dialogue is going, we need to do this in order to do this in order to do this. Screenplays have become very streamlined, and instead of giving you any sort of ambiguity, they seem to just tell you what's happening and how it is resolved very simply. The idea of ambiguity kind of falls out of, you know, you're not getting that anymore unless you're kind of watching something like from Christopher Nolan, and even then, you know, people are like, oh, well, why has he done that? Why is it an open-ended ending? And I think that's one thing, you know, Donnie Darko does quite well. It is quite ambiguous, but I think one of the things I liked about it is I just felt for the character. that's really nice. It's really nice to turn around, and I think one reason why I think a lot of people liked it, we were all roughly around that age, or maybe a little bit younger, you know, heading towards adolescence, and he kind of consolidated a lot of things that we felt about being an outsider, about being maybe a bit geeky and not fitting in, but feeling that there's something that you can do and everything. It just happens to be saving the world. I think that's the thing that works. I think it's all about Gyllenhaal and what he does and how he sells that performance. I don't think, you know, I think I've watched it with my girlfriend at least once. When I watch stuff with my girlfriend is very much in a sense of, at the end of stuff, she's like, well, what happens after? What happens next if I show her something kind of ambiguous or open-ended? Whereas I'm kind of okay with that. I'm more about those characters at that moment in time and how it makes me feel at that moment in time. And I think that's the best thing about the film. I think it is really just a fantastic coming-of-age story. You know, very kind of John Hughes at the best of times. just shades of David Lynch around that time as well. There's, you know, there's just some beautiful aspects about it, and I think, interestingly, that kind of gets lost with the whole time travel stuff. But I might, you know, I might be...
Anything more to say on Donnie Darko before we move on?
I've got a story that involves the rabbit suit.
Right.
When the film came out, we went to London to watch it, as I mentioned. We went to the Curzon Soho, Save the Curzon Soho, it's a great cinema. And we... It was me and a friend, we went, and we all, a few friends, we went and we loved it, and it was really, really good. And my friend, for a Halloween thing, made the suit. Like, a really good version of the rabbit suit. It was really, really good. He did a really, really good job on it. And he had it for quite a while. Now, around 2004, he still had the suit. And I was like, "You still got the suit?" He said, "Yes." And we were working at a cinema at a time. And one of the people that we were working with went on a date with this girl. And it was Halloween. And we were working. We were doing the late. To which I hear my mate go, "I bought the suit because it's Halloween." So he puts on the suit during, I think it might have been The Grudge. And he travels, it's a stadium seating, so he travelled up the stairs of a packed cinema on a late show, dressed as Frank the Rabbit. Dressed as Frank the Rabbit, saying nothing to anyone as he walks up, dead slow, really slow, up to the aisle seat where my other friend was sitting. Sits down really slow, just looks at him, asks him, "Has he ever seen a portal?" My mate is in absolute tears. He's laughing. He knows who it is and everything else like that. He then decides to get up, walk all the way down really slow again, and just scare the absolute living crap out of everyone in that screen because no one knows who he is apart from that one person in the screen. And to that day, I wish he kept the suit. I think he actually got rid of it, which is a bit of a shame. I think he dismantled it. But my God, just it was back at a time when you could do stuff like that in a cinema, and you know, people wouldn't mind too much. But you know, I strongly urge anyone who works at a cinema who listens to this to make yourself a Frank the Rabbit suit, and you know, come October or come any late show horror film, to do something fun like that. But that was my story. I didn't mean to sell it better than it actually was.
And for the nomination of Donnie Darko, we've got Jacob Barnes, who is on Twitter at JumpCutJacob for that one. Right, before we finish this week's Pick a Flick, we've got the quiz, which will focus on the two films as our which were our main reviews. Question one: as the Jordanian informant enters Camp Chapman in Zero Dark Thirty, what can be seen cutting across his path?
Oh God, I can't remember.
I'll give you a clue then. It was a kind of animal.
Oh, was it a monkey?
No, it was a black cat. Okay. Question two: name the song in Donnie Darko playing as he rides his bike.
Killing Moon?
Yeah. Yes, that's correct. The Killing Moon by Echo and the Bunnymen. Question three: who was originally cast as the main role in Zero Dark Thirty before dropping out to be replaced by Jessica Chastain?
Can we do clues?
I don't really know how to do a clue for this one. I can't think of anything off the top of my head that would...
I was just wanting to know if it was a male or female, that's all.
It's a female.
It is a female. Julianne Moore?
No. It was Rooney Mara.
Oh, wow.
Question four: in Donnie Darko, what is the exact time Frank tells Donnie the world will end in?
Oh, God.
So how many days, hours, minutes, seconds does Frank say tell Donnie
it's
the world went
28 in? Days, 14 hours, 12 minutes and 8 seconds?
You're bright with 28 hours. Which president does someone wear a mask of at the house party while jumping on the trampoline in Donnie Darko?
Reagan.
That's right, correct, yes.
So yes, that's almost all for this week's Pick a Flick, but we're all going to plug our various other websites and blogs and podcasts now, so let's...
You can find me at afrofilmviewer.com. I'm usually talking nonsense there. I've also got a cinema podcast. It's a 6-episode cinema podcast at the moment. We're on episode 5, called Cinematic Dramatic, and we've also got loads of previous episodes before, and that's on iTunes. I can also be found on London Economic and Geek Planet Online.
And I am part of Failed Critics, which is www.failedcritics.com or at Failed Critics on Twitter. I'm at Failed Steve, my own account, and we are a weekly film podcast reviewing new films. We occasionally do specials, Hall of Fame, that kind of thing as well, and articles going up on the website sporadically. And this has been Pick a Flick, which you can follow on Twitter at Pick a Flick Pod, also on iTunes, Acast and Stitcher, where you can find this podcast. Well, obviously you're listening to it, so you know where to find it, but if you could leave a review, that'd be excellent, and follow us on Twitter. We're always looking for feedback, comments and recommendations for what films to watch on the podcast itself.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.